All right. The next case of the day is In Re Classy Properties, number 13-1277. Mr. Wallace.
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honor, the issue in this case, and I believe the following case, is what a mortgage must contain in order to pass muster under Illinois law if it is to bind good faith purchasers. The bankruptcy court erred when it determined that a mortgage is assessed by looking simply at the quantum of information it contains. That's the standard the court adopted. And it's not a standard. In fact, it's a non-standard. It leaves the determination of whether a mortgage is sufficient to a case-by-case-by-case analysis, which is unnecessary and untenable, especially in the context of bankruptcy cases. Section 11 of the Conveyances Act, at first glance, appears to be permissive. It says a mortgage may be in substantially the following form. And it sets forth a litany or a recipe, if you will, for what constitutes a sufficient mortgage. Again, at first glance, it appears to be permissive. Reading farther, though, it says, refers to at least two elements of that recipe as requirements. When the legislature carved out reverse mortgages, it's referred to principal amount of the debt, or the amount of the indebtedness, and maturity date as requirements for the contents of a mortgage. First of all, if the first part of what is now subsection A of section 11 is nothing more than a suggestion, if you will, there is no reason to give any carve-out to reverse mortgages. They'd be compliant no matter what. Secondly, the legislature knows how to use the word require, and it referred to principal amount or amount of indebtedness and maturity date as requirements. The statute then provides that a mortgage must contain the information set forth in Section 11, which is the name of the mortgagors, the name of the mortgagee, the nature and amount of the indebtedness, the principal, or the maturity date, the interest rate, what is the evidence of debt, the signature of the mortgagors, the date of the instrument, and a legal description. Now, we've heard that this is just an unreasonable and apparently a cumbersome or burdensome process. The recipe is simple. There are maybe 10 or 11 different identifiers of the debt that are set forth in subsection A. There's no reason in the world a mortgage cannot recite all of those elements. Now, the bankruptcy court went on to determine that incorporation by reference in a mortgage or reference to other documents is sufficient. But what the court didn't consider is that the issue when we're dealing with bona fide purchasers such as a trustee is not what is outside the record, but it's what is on the record. Those extraneous documents are not part of the record. Go see my note. Go see the note. That note is not part of the record.
Who has actual notice, though, that's treated as sufficient, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think this court made that point in Peoples.
Okay. Can I ask you, Mr. Wallace, has any court in Illinois avoided a mortgage for anybody, that is, the borrowers or a bankruptcy trustee, for failure to include the interest rate or the maturity date?
Your Honor, one case, Flexter, which is a Fifth District appellate case, the mortgage lacked a statement as to principal amount and maturity date.
Well, clearly, principal amount is a big problem. But given the statutory default, if you're silent as to maturity date, it's 30 years. Why is maturity date so important?
Your Honor, I think it's important, and I don't mean to be flippant when I say this, but it's important because that's what the statute provides.
But the statute also provides another provision says if it's silent, it's 30 years. I take it that there's no case that has avoided a mortgage because of the absence of an interest rate.
I found none, nor is there one that has validated a mortgage that didn't disclose the interest rate. The first case that did so was this case. Class C was the first case that validated a mortgage that lacked, at least as to a bona fide purchaser, that lacked one of the elements set forth in subsection A. And if I may address the statute of limitations issue, Your Honor, that issue, although it provides a 30-year outside date for commencement of litigation to foreclose a mortgage that doesn't contain a maturity date, it doesn't deal with whether or not that such a mortgage would be binding upon a bona fide purchaser. Shara Manning Properties, which I think both parties have cited, says that failure to comply with the statute, Section 11, does not render a mortgage void. It's enforceable as between the parties, parties in privity, or perhaps parties with actual knowledge. But that doesn't address whether or not it's binding as to a bona fide purchaser. And that's what we have here as a bona fide purchaser in the form of a bankruptcy trustee.
Can we agree that that is totally fictional? That is, I can't imagine anybody actually buying this property having found this mortgage of record, right?
You are absolutely correct, Your Honor.
So we're in a kind of never-never land here.
We're in a never-never land because, number one, constructive notice, no matter its form, is a fiction. We're saying the law, we're going to assume that you've seen this document, even though you've never seen this document.
If you've seen this document, nobody would ever buy this property.
If you've seen the document, not a soul would buy the property. And as a practical matter, and I think the court can know this, knows this anecdotally, when a bank makes a mortgage loan, when someone buys a piece of property, they're not going to go like this, cover their eyes, and hope that they've got clear title. And I held my tongue there, Your Honor, that they have clear title. They're going to get title insurance. They're going to run a title search. This is very unique because it is a bankruptcy trustee, and his eyes are deemed closed. He doesn't have any knowledge, has deemed to have no actual knowledge of this transaction, of this mortgage.
He's deemed to have knowledge of the recorded document, right?
If it is substantively compliant.
He's deemed to have knowledge of the document.
Your Honor, he is, if it's recorded, and I think I would refer to, and I think the court adverted to it in the Peoples and Banterra case, that the standard for record notice is twofold. First of all, obviously the document has to be recorded. Otherwise there would be no notice. But secondly, it has to be substantively sufficient. And the only substantive requirements for a mortgage are set forth in Section 11. So it's a two-step process if a lender, a mortgagee, wants to bind a BFP, and that is recording and substantive compliance. Because if you simply record a document, and I've cited the St. John against Conger case and another Illinois decision that says you can't just record anything and have it confer notice. If that were the case, In the Bullock case, the Caraway case, the Flexter case, mere recordation of a document would have bound those parties. Those documents were each lacking in a piece of information, and even though they were recorded, they did not confer any type of notice on the purchaser. And that would be the situation here as to the trustee. Your Honor, I think I've spoken enough for now. I'll reserve my time for rebuttal.
All right, thank you. Let's see, Ms. Stevenson.
May it please the Court, Your Honor. My name is Joanne Stevenson. I'm attorney for Farmer State Bank in this case. The first point I want to address is the amendment to Section 11, which was became law June 1st of this year. That amendment, as pointed out in the Banterra Bank case by this court, merely clarified Section 11. It did not change Section 11 in any way. That amendment specifically stated that the provisions of subsection A regarding the form of a mortgage are and always have been permissive and not mandatory. Accordingly, the failure of any otherwise lawfully executed and recorded mortgage to be in the form described in subsection A in one or more respects, including the failure to state an interest rate or the maturity date or both, shall not affect the validity or priority of the mortgage, nor shall its recordation be ineffective for notice purposes, regardless of when the mortgage was recorded. Now, although that case became law while this case was pending, the amendments to statutes that merely clarify are applied retroactively, including to pending cases. And I can cite Seventh Circuit case Middleton versus City of Chicago, 578 F3rd 655. That's a 2009 case. Basically says when an amendment clarifies a statute, it's applied retroactively and to all cases pending at the time. And also an Illinois case, Felato, F-E-L-A-T-O, versus Teachers Retirement Systems of the State of Illinois. And that is a First District case, 1991, 568 Northeast 2nd, 233. That case, I think, that amendment pretty much resolves this issue. If there was, in fact, a question at all, excuse me.
Vincent, well, there is a question. Obviously, we've had bankruptcy courts going in different directions on this problem, and that's why we took this case on a direct appeal from the bankruptcy court. Under your view of the law, old or new, what is indispensable?
As far as what's required in the form of a mortgage.
To have in a recorded mortgage to keep it binding upon a bona fide purchaser.
I think you have to look at what the legal requirements of a mortgage is. And I think that's set forth, I know that's set forth by both statute and by case law. And under the provisions, I will cite this. Mortgage is defined by statute as any consensual lien created by a written instrument which grants or retains an interest in real estate to secure a debt or other obligation, and that's 735 ILCS 5/15-1207. That's the statutory requirement for a mortgage. Case law has already set out, long-term case law has set out the requirements of a mortgage. It requires a conveyance, the intention to secure a debt, and there being an underlying debt. So I believe that the requirements of a mortgage, a mortgage has to have sufficient information to denote the document as a mortgage. You have to identify the parties to the mortgage. You have to identify that there is, in fact, a conveyance. You have to identify the legal description of the real estate. It has to indicate that there was an intention to secure a debt, so there has to be a debt identified on the documents as well. Those are the essential terms of a mortgage.
How about something as simple as the owner of the property gave me a mortgage in return for a debt?
Period. I think,
signed, John Doe.
I think you have, and I think the Illinois Supreme Court case law has been clear, I think you have to identify the debt itself.
Okay.
So you have to identify, I believe, the amount of the debt.
Okay. You've been arguing, if I recall correctly, though, we should be able to combine the so-called record notice with inquiry notice, right?
I believe those are two different types of constructive notice.
Maybe combined.
I believe that a document, a recorded document, can incite inquiry notice.
Okay, so why doesn't my hypothetical, the owner of this property, 123 Jones Avenue, gave me a mortgage for a debt on this date, signed John Doe. Now, it doesn't identify the debt, but it would be inquiry notice, right?
It could lead to the requirement that a third party do further inquiry to determine the nature of the debt.
Would that be enough to enforce against a bona fide purchaser?
I believe if that is in a recorded document and if it shows up on the record of title, so that you have the grantor and the grantee properly identified, because that is another requirement of the document. It has to be able to be found in the record of title in order for it to become constructive notice.
It's recorded for the property and identified the property.
Okay, if you have the correct grantor, the grantee, the legal description, and the identity that there is in the information in the document that the conveyance was done for the purpose of securing a debt, Do I think that in that situation, is the amount of the debt going to be necessary, or could that put them on inquiry notice to have to do further investigation? If, in fact, the information is available and can be investigated, it could be sufficient. And in this particular case, the statute is very clear that the provisions within the statute are permissive and not mandatory. It states specifically that a mortgage may be in substantially the following form. That's not the same thing as saying that it shall be in this form, which means it requires this every element that's listed on there in order for it to be a valid mortgage and to impart notice to third parties. There's many provisions within Section 11 that do use the word shall, that do use mandatory language. And it's telling also that in those provisions where they do use the mandatory language shall, it's also followed up by saying that if you don't do what we just said you shall do, it doesn't affect the validity of the mortgage. You see that also in Section 35C of the Recording Act, which has lists many different things that are required to be in documents regarding the legal description of the property, that the document has to be notarized. All of those things are described within the mandate. It shall be in this. It shall include these documents. But it's always these elements. But it's always followed by the statement that the failure to comply with this does not invalidate the instrument. So throughout the Conveyances Act, there are many mandates. In each of the mandates, it's followed by, but failure to comply with this does not invalidate the recording. So then we go back to Section A, which states that a mortgage may be substantially in the following form. And the trustee would have the court read that as being a mandate, notwithstanding the permissive language. One of the things that the trustee has never been able to explain to the court is what is the necessity of the interest rate and the maturity date? Why is it necessary to be on a recorded document in order to impart notice? It is not considered a requirement of a mortgage, either by statute or by case law. But yet the trustee argues that without those two pieces of information, it's tantamount to the document not having been recorded at all. And that is something that the trustee has never been able to explain, either in his briefs or in the lower court. Why is the maturity date a necessity in a recorded document in order to impart notice? Why is the interest rate a necessity? And as the court pointed out, too, if, in fact, all of the elements of Section 11 are necessary and must be in the document, then why does the Conveyances Act then proceed to provide a default maturity date of 30 years? It doesn't make any sense that if these are all necessary and must be in a document in order for it to be a validly recorded instrument, then why would the Conveyances Act provide a default maturity date? And I also want to address briefly the incorporation by reference. If, in fact, it's found to be necessary that the maturity date and the interest rate have to be in the document, they were contained in the contemporaneously executed loan documents. The interest rate, the maturity date, are both in the promissory note. The promissory note refers back to the mortgage. The mortgage refers back to the promissory note.
The note's not recorded, is it?
The note is not recorded, no. But the note and all of the loan documents contemporaneously executed are incorporated by reference in the mortgage document. So if, in fact, the court would deem that those are two necessary elements of a mortgage, they are contained within the loan documents which were incorporated by reference in the mortgage.
Would that be a preferable way to decide the case rather than rely on the statute? Can we simply say that that information was incorporated by reference?
I think first the permissive nature of Section 11 has to be taken into consideration.
Why do you think it's we have to take that into consideration?
I think because the statute itself is very clear that that the form of the mortgage is permissive, and the amendment makes that abundantly clear that those particular items are not necessary for a mortgage.
You haven't said anything about this judicial estoppel question that's raised in the briefs. Do you want to say anything about that?
Yeah, just I will basically address the fact that Farmer State Bank had filed a motion for relief from stay in the bankruptcy court. And during the course of that proceeding, the bankruptcy trustee agreed to the motion for relief from stay. And in that agreement, entered into an order agreeing that when the property was sold throughout the mortgage foreclosure, that Farmer State Bank would first get the proceeds. And he would, and the trustee would only be entitled to whatever was left over and above payment of Farmer State Bank's mortgage.
There was no reservation of any question in that situation, in that agreement.
In that in that agreed upon order, the trustee specifically agreed that Farmer State Bank's mortgage would take priority. They would get the proceeds of the sale first. And only if there was any remaining after due and owing to Farmer State Bank, the trustee would get that. Essentially, he agreed and consented that Farmer State Bank's mortgage at that point had priority.
Could I ask you to respond to the trustee's arguments in his reply brief on this point to the effect that those are expedited proceedings that we want to go very fast without requiring people in the trustee's position to fight with lenders at that point about priority?
That may be the case.
I assume that you all wanted to go forward, foreclose quickly, right?
We did want to go forward,
without litigating all of these issues.
Obviously, but that was at that point in time, Your Honor, the trustee should have raised his issue that he did not believe that we had priority. At that point in time, he conceded that the Farmer State Bank had priority in the mortgage and we would be entitled for it. That wasn't even necessary as far as agreement with respect to the motion for relief from stay.
Is that agreed upon motion in the record?
The order is in the record.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Stevenson.
Thank you.
Rebuttal, Mr. Wallace.
Mr. Wallace, I would appreciate your views on this judicial estoppel question. Raise it in your earlier remarks, and I think it's rather important.
Your Honor, judicial estoppel, as the appellees pointed out in their brief, requires, there's one element that it requires, and that is that the party to be estopped has convinced the court or has obtained some type of benefit from the court by taking a certain position before it. And in this context, the bankruptcy court was convinced of nothing because it was a stipulation. We stipulated that farmers would get first money, any other intervening liens would get second money, the trustee would get the third money.
Well, maybe it's just a waiver on your part.
Well, Your Honor, if the issue of avoidance were there in the context of a motion for relief from the automatic stay, perhaps then it would be considered a waiver. But I think this court's decision in Vitreous Steel indicates that avoidance is not an issue in the context of a motion for relief from stay. Therefore, the issue can't be waived. Moreover,
so why we wouldn't expect you at least to, in writing, reserve the question.
Your Honor, not necessarily so, because there is a 2-year statute of limitations. So the trustee might not necessarily have known at that point whether or not there was an avoidance action. That's why a lift stay proceeding is of its nature an expedited procedure, and the only issue being determined is whether or not the movement has a colorable claim. If I may
take an extra minute.
Your Honor, first of all, the amendment to Section 11, I would state simply that it's nonsensical with all respect to the 97 General Assembly, because as you read it, it means that a mortgage need contain nothing.
Do you think we should decide this case on the basis that the Illinois General Assembly is nonsensical?
Your Honor, I think the court can do so. I think the court can take a look at what the Illinois General Assembly said. That is, in sum and substance, a mortgage needn't contain any information. And I think the court can look at that and decide that it is nonsensical, and we should not use that as a basis for making our determination here. Moreover, it's directly in conflict with another provision of the statute, which refers to maturity date and principal amount as requirements. So I think the court can do so. Secondly, it also raises a separation of powers problem under the Illinois Constitution. I've used enough of my time, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wallace. We'll move with the cases taken under advisement.